Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everyone. I'm alive. It feels so good.
You sound great. You sound better than you did 2 episodes prior. So I'm glad that you worked through whatever you were going through, but you sound better than ever, stronger than ever.
A little bit of COVID-19 does the heart good. Now, I don't know
Shit,
what I had.
Do you think that's...
I think I might have, because I had so much brain fog. Like, I'm amazed I got through the episode last week, because looking back, I was dysfunctional for 5 days fully. So God. I'm glad to be back.
No, well, we're glad to have you back. And, you know, listening back to the episode last week, I listened to some of it, and it was all a bit too... Bit too Alex Macera's show for my life, even for my liking. So that tells you how little you did contribute. Yeah, imagine. I really thought, God, he needs to be better for next week, because I need that American opinionated voice to balance me out on the pod.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm glad to be back. And we have some very interesting discussions for you guys today. One topic we love to come back to here on air, which I think is really a... It's a sign of our times that we live in.
Yeah, that's true.
A move away from large capacity planes, the A380, namely talking about the A321LR and XLR, the aircraft that is changing everything. And do you, Alex, want to summarize what are some of the points we've said about what we think about the use of this aircraft so far in the industry is?
Yeah, of course, because increasingly we are receiving messages from listeners. We are hearing, you know, just anecdotally from relatives, friends, people that we know, that where perhaps, let's say you take a yearly flight to go and see relatives in Washington, for example, or you're used to flying across the Atlantic from the East Coast to somewhere like Paris or Madrid or even London. Increasingly now, where over the years you will have been used to the typical kind of long-haul aircraft that you see in the movies with two aisles and, you know, multiple seats spread out across the cabin in different layouts and the whole kind of typical long-haul experience. Increasingly now, that is being swapped and traded in for single aisle because of the introduction of the A321LR or XLR, or even the slightly smaller range version, the A321neo, which is giving airlines this possibility to fly long haul on short haul economics. And we have touched on this quite a few times throughout the podcast, but now airlines are receiving this, the airlines that have been patiently waiting for these aircraft at such a rate that a lot more of you are experiencing it for the first time. And as that continues, we are receiving more and more feedback both from the public and also from airlines about how this is actually working. What happens when you swap the typical long-haul experience of a wide-body long-haul twin-aisle jet for an aircraft that is actually the same size as one that you'd fly 2 hours on in Europe, for example, from London to Portugal? And how does that, you know, when that meets long-haul, how does it all go down? And so that's why we wanted to start by discussing this, because we have a few notes from people that have fed back to us inside the industry as to what they believe is going on. But also, crucially, you, Dan, are fresh off of a long haul on an A321LR. Admittedly, not too much of a long haul, But let's go through that.
It's one of the, you know, sort of intended uses of this plane.
It is, exactly. So take us through, for anyone that hasn't seen your video, and I encourage anyone to check the video after this episode so this can provide us some decent context.
Yeah.
Was this your first A321LR flight?
No. You should know, everyone should know, that I think my first one was, drumroll, Gothenburg to New York, when SAS RIP had that route for one summer.
That's true. But you see how easily forgettable that is, that even I forgot that route / mistake existed for a mere few weeks.
Wow, mistake. No, so I have flown
mistakes,
it before.
Even SAS.
That was a truly long flight. That was like 8 hours, which really starts to push it. But yeah. I had the joy, actually, of flying this aircraft on Etihad, which is one of only two airlines so far in the world, although Delta is also coming up, to operate this with reverse herringbone seats. And if you don't know what those are, these are one of the most common long-haul, wide-body business class seat types, where the seat is closer to the aisle and you face the window, which, funnily enough, a lot of the feedback I got on the video that I made from Etihad was that, I hate when the seats are far from the window like that and face the window. I want to sit close to the window and face the aisle, which, like, pretty much unanimously, people have previously agreed that those so-called herringbone seats that face the aisle are way inferior to a reverse herringbone. So I found that feedback kind of surprising, but yeah, it is, in my opinion, I think in your opinion, in most people's opinion, amazing to have a reverse herringbone seat like that, that faces the window for more privacy. And it's just so cool. As I said in the video, when you board a narrow body and you see a reverse herringbone cabin like that, only ITA Airways so far has that before Etihad. It's a true wow moment, because it is finally a real long haul, you know, wide body experience on a narrow body. But as I highlight in the video as well, there are a few drawbacks still of being on a smaller plane, which we can get into.
Yeah. So of course you're experiencing this in first class, not even business class, but that kind of business elite style product, first class, which is not its own separate cabin, as your video clearly shows, but is rather just a different seat. The first row of business is considered, it's a class of its own, which is a slight gamble of Etihad to take this to the market. But you explain that and assess that very well in your video on your channel, so I'll let the listeners check that out. But let's recognize that the majority of people that are flying in economy, and the majority that would have been flying that existing route, whether it be the route that you did or whether it be, actually, it's better to look at the transatlantic routes that have existed for a longer period of time. If they'd flown it before, they would typically have flown it on a wide body, large aircraft, like a 777 or a 767 perhaps, or the Airbus equivalent with something like a 330, maybe even a 340. Maybe even a 380. I mean, that is, I would need to double check if there is a route that has actually been downgraded from a 380 to a 321LR, well, but I'm sure somewhere it exists, especially there, with the East Coast.
It's not specifically a downgrade, but Etihad will fly the A321LR from Abu Dhabi to Paris simultaneously as operating an A380 on a different frequency. So you'll have the
and
option
that's where
of
you begin to
either
realize
flying an A380 or this.
And that's where you begin to realize how the airline is almost, not just Etihad, but actually a lot of airlines are unapologetic in that, because they don't feel, as I just referred to it, as a downgrade from something like a 380, but they feel they are going forward able to maintain everything that you, the public, like of a long-haul experience. So typically you have a more comfortable seat. Typically you have in-flight entertainment. You still have that element of onboard service. Everything that you expect in a standard, you know, economy, long-haul bundle, they're saying that they replicate all of that. Just the difference is that instead of the cabin being, you know, 3-3-3 or even 3-4-3 across or 2-4-2, or depending on aircraft, it's just 3-3. It's
yeah.
akin to what you're used to if you fly short haul. Now, we are very much immersed into the industry and have, I would say, sometimes our perceptions are guided by what we know to be true in the industry rather than how the public feel. I heard from a friend, right? I'm going to summarize her message. And she said that she was horrified to board a flight that is typically a long-haul aircraft. She would fly on a 777 that is now a 321LR. And I had explained to her that this is the direction of travel we're in now in aviation. And I asked her why she felt it was less comfortable, because I reminded her that her seat pitch was exactly the same. The seat itself was actually newer, a newer generation economy seat from the manufacturer with better design to maximize
and the
comfort.
The seat could actually be wider if it's compared to a 787, for example.
Correct, because they've got a bit more room to play with given the reduced number of seats on board. So a wider seat, and it was a wider seat in this scenario, a much better in-flight entertainment than on the old 777s she had previously been flying. Better air quality because it's a newer aircraft with newer technology to introduce fresher air into the cabin every 2 to 3 minutes versus something like every 10 to 15 minutes. The level of onboard service still being offered, the same dinner on the evening flight, the same snack before arrival. So I wanted to understand she came to me back. She said to me this. She said, number one, she said the lavatory situation is a problem because the reality is it is still a small aircraft and there were queues for lavatories that she said she doesn't remember seeing on the wide-body aircraft where there are more lavatories. That's probably true. She said that the service was slower and she felt that this is probably to do with the fact that they have reduced galley space, because she was working out that actually on the previous aircraft that used to fly this route, you'd have multiple galleys, multiple kitchen areas for the crew in simple terms throughout the aircraft for the crew to prepare the service. And instead they were just doing it out of half of one because the other half is taken up by a lavatory. And then she also said she just couldn't break away from the passenger psychology of the fact that a narrow body small aircraft is for short haul, and that it just didn't sit right with her that we're in this small, what she perceived to be cramped aircraft, even though we just mentioned how her seat pitch and width were better. She perceived it to feel cramped, more tube-like, more aware that the other side of the cabin was within, you know, you could touch it, and therefore she felt it was just more uncomfortable. And I think there are a lot of people that share that sentiment with her. What do you think?
I agree. It just is not as nice of an experience, because especially if we're comparing it to an A380, where you have this sense of space, the ceiling is so high, you have this huge gap between the window seats and the wall, which a lot of people enjoy, except those that want to lean against the cabin wall to sleep. But I agree that if I could choose in economy, if I could choose an aircraft, the A321LR or A320neo in general would always be the lowest on my choices of long-haul aircraft. But the key here is that this aircraft is supposed to, and this is something we've complained about so many times before on the podcast, it's supposed to be placed on long, thin routes that do not have any other long-haul flights or do not have connectivity. So it's supposed to enable connectivity, which that was the idea behind this aircraft. And unfortunately, as we've seen, and something we've pointed out time and time again, that has not really materialized. Yes, in some cases, but Etihad is doing a mixed approach, I would say. They're launching some exciting, unique destinations that don't have long-haul service, like Chiang Mai, like direct flights to Phnom Penh, while Qatar and Emirates only fly through other Asian cities to get there. They're using this to go daily to Copenhagen, for example, which is a bit lame compared to Emirates flying the A380 and Qatar being three times daily. But they're sending it to a few places where the use is correct. But then they're also sending it, like my flight, to Phuket or to Bangkok or to Paris. And in those cases, I think the only reason to choose those flights would be if it was cheaper. And what I heard Etihad saying a lot initially was that, don't worry, the A321 flights will be cheaper, at least in premium cabins, especially in first class. But now I just did a little search for fun. I did Phuket to Paris on Etihad first class to try to see, because Phuket to Abu Dhabi will have the A321neo in first class. But then to Paris, we have three first class options on Etihad. Every day, we'll have one on the A321neo next summer, one on their 787 first class, and one on the A380. So we get a comparison between all the first class products they offer. And guess what? To my horror, they charge the exact same amount for all those options. Meaning,
but how could they compare?
You could choose the
A380. Yeah, but you know, how could they compare what you just flew as quote first to A380 first? That's impossible.
And that's the problem, which I thought, and I do think this is the case on some routes sometimes, that the A321 first class will be in the middle of the market. It will be between business and other first class products in terms of pricing, so that for people, it will actually be a very worthwhile upgrade. But if you're faced with a situation like this, then yeah, no way should anyone choose the A321 over the A380 or the 787. So proceed with caution. And that's what I don't like, is that this is really one of those aircraft that is forcing people, I think, to educate themselves, which, you know, we're pro that. But to a lot of people, it's a lot of unnecessary effort to think, oh, just clicking one flight as opposed to another, but they cost the same, could have a vastly different implication, you know, different implication on what my onboard experience is like.
Now, I would argue that that sets a dangerous precedent. And I say this not by exaggerating, but seriously, let's use Etihad as the example, because you are fresh off of that product and that flight. With you just explaining now that you checking and actually that pricing first class the same across three different aircraft types, despite the fundamental, I mean, it's chalk and cheese. Imagine the couple that have saved up their hard-earned cash in order to take the trip of a lifetime, and they say they're going to do it in first, and they're flying from Paris, for example. To pay the same for what you just experienced on a narrow-body, tight A321, as it would be if they ended up on an A380, where their first wouldn't be a simple first class seat, which is more like a business seat, as you can see in your video, but instead a whole apartment. The product is literally known as an apartment because it is huge and vast in terms of space. And
you have a shower.
Google it
on
yourself
board.
If you haven't seen it. You have a shower on board. You have this whole living space area. It's not merely a seat. It's one of the most impressive first class that has hit the market ever in recent commercial aviation history. To price that as the same as what you had just flown in a 321, that is a legal battle waiting to commence. That reminds me of the gentleman who successfully sued Emirates because they kept showing him photos of the new first class that actually had never flown to his home market, and he won. I would say that's something that definitely needs addressing, because you can't compare. You were in a tighter aircraft on the 321, and you also knew what you were going into, right? So what I would want to know is how you would feel if you had booked the A380 apartment, knowing you're getting this huge living space and a shower, and they had swapped it for the 321, given that it flies and operates on the same route you were flying, you would consider that a massive downgrade. And I expect you would be looking for some kind of compensation, right?
For sure. Yeah. But they haven't switched. What they've done is they've added an additional frequency that didn't exist before.
I know,
before.
But what I'm saying is because they've added the frequency on the same route, it potentially gives them the option to switch for operational reasons because of the way that they both operate alongside each other to the same destination, right?
Yes, but this is not something Etihad is known to do. So, look,
no,
I wouldn't
I'm
say
just
that,
speaking hypothetically.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that that specifically is a concern, but I do 100% agree that it's very, I mean, if you go on their website now, what I do like is that when you select each flight, it literally shows you a picture of what the first class seat is on the plane you're booking. It shows you, so you know exactly what to expect. I will say the first class seat, the picture of the first class seat they chose for the A321LR, might be a little bit deceiving. Everyone who's looking to fly Etihad first should, of course, watch my videos beforehand. I agree. It sets a weird and potentially risky precedent, but we'll see. This aircraft is only going to get more and more common in the future.
And that's why we're discussing it.
Yeah, that's... But again, overall, great flight. And for what I paid, good deal. But I was very clear in the video, if the price starts creeping up, then not necessarily such a good deal anymore. So,
and did you notice anything, for example, the forward galley, which is responsible for all of business class, as well as trying to deliver a first class service to the first two rows, was that fine? Were they smooth? Was it quiet? Was it because they're in a confined space and it's a short haul aircraft in terms of the cabin?
I had a Japanese flight attendant, which should say everything we need to know about how quiet and efficient it was. She was incredible. And also, as you saw, Oscar and I, between the two of us, were served like 25 different dishes because we were sampling that menu, the new vegan menu that Etihad has developed. And I was amazed at how hard the crew managed to work, how they managed to present everything so nicely directly on the table, everything crew plated in every cabin, well, business and first. Granted, my flight was only half full. I was very grateful because if it had been full, we wouldn't have been able to do what we did and try all those dishes because it would have just been an absolute nightmare for the crew. But of course, as anyone who's flown the A321LR long haul will know, service is in general much slower, especially on airlines that are trying to have some level of crew plating or serve, many courses. So there is an argument, I would say, to, again, if airlines charge less for this aircraft, to simplify the service a little bit to make things faster. But when you're going to offer dine on demand, like Etihad offers, when you're going to offer so many courses, I imagine it can get really crazy. And I feel so bad for the crew. It's one thing as a passenger, but for the crew to have two crew working on preparing meals for 14 business passengers, two first class passengers in a galley that is literally the size of a small walk-in closet is unbelievable.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well, look, let's jump from first class to economy, and we'll also jump from Abu Dhabi over to Korea, where perhaps some fantastic news has emerged, at least in the interest of the consumer. And this is particularly interesting because Korean Air has always had a pretty generous economy class and I would argue a more comfortable economy class experience than other Asian carriers that are way more focused on the premium cabins, on business, on first, or those that have premium economy. And that's where a lot of the innovation has gone. But as I said at the beginning of the episode and at the top, most passengers and still a lot of the financial bottom line for airlines is from those that are traveling in economy class and on more than one flight, connecting and so on. Korean Air were planning to go from, in the 777 aircraft, a 333 configuration, which they are really only one of the handful of airlines with this spacious layout in economy with 333. I will note that almost every other 777 economy class cabins, whether it's with British Airways, whether it's over in the United States, whether it's across the continent of Africa, they have 343. And that, obviously, imagine in the same space they've been able to introduce an additional seat in the middle, that significantly impacted the comfort level in economy when they did that. But it's become the industry norm. It's the industry standard. Most people don't notice it anymore. So Korean Air, and I would say, is Japan Airlines, they still have the 333, don't they? That's a red line for them.
Yeah, and even on some aircraft, I think they have 4-2 or something. Let me check. But they have a super unique. Actually, they might have retired those. I'll look it up while you explain more.
So Korean Air, one of the few airlines left in economy class with 333. And that's great. And if I was recommending travel for people that are going anywhere in Asia, and if they're going to Korea, or if they're connecting via Korea, or it's they're going around, maybe they're going to Japan, for example, and they're flying via Korea, it's a decent option, because ultimately you're flying in a cabin with one seat that doesn't exist on every single row, compared with the competitors that all have that extra seat, and therefore cuts into the aisle space, cuts into your seat width, and so on. So that's been their industry norm in Korea for Korean Air, but not for the actual global industry who are on 343. Now, they are in the process of reconfiguring these aircraft to go to 343, meaning that they are going to add in that extra seat per row and follow the rest of the industry and reduce the seat pitch and the comfort level for everyone in the cabin to follow other airlines. What we've seen here is something very rare, which is that Korean, which is currently in the process of this very complicated, very complex, long, pretty drawn out attempted merger with Asiana, has received some pressure from its regulator and those that are in the interest of consumer rights and the Fair Trade Organization in Korea, that has stepped in to suspend and prevent Korean Air from increasing the number of seats in economy, forcing them to stop mid-program, so mid, in the middle of their configuration program. Some are already done, the rest are still to be reconfigured, and they're ultimately have been banned from by the ag regulator from installing these extra seats, saying that they have to keep 333 in order to maintain the comfort levels and not change anything that the passengers of Korean Air are used to. So this is the regulator really looking into something that, you know, is not that big of a bold move, Korean Air following the rest of the industry, standing up and intervening for you, the consumer, and being quite clear, Korean Air, you're not adding an extra seat. You are keeping this comfortable economy. What do we think? Because it's probably the first time that we've seen this in history of a regulator getting involved and standing up for the economy class passenger.
I know. So there's two perspectives, right? There's the passenger perspective, where I absolutely love this. And it's so refreshing, I think, in this era where you just feel like the industry can get away with everything, with acquisitions that don't really benefit the customer at all, with a continuous degrading of the onboard experience. It's really refreshing to see a regulator say, nah, 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 you need to not maintain happening a high standard here. From the airline perspective, especially for Korean Air, which has, you know, the Korean airline industry has been a little bit tumultuous. We've spoken before on the podcast how Seoul has become one of the lowest yield and cheapest premium origins in the world for flight bookings. So it's not exactly an easy market for them to operate in. Not to mention the fact that Korea's population in the coming few decades is going to collapse. So from the airline's perspective, not at all ideal, especially since they've already had time to reconfigure one aircraft. So the regulator has said, you don't need to put that one back in a 343 config. You just need to not do the other aircraft. So this leaves them with one plane with this new seat layout, that's which is just so messy, so inefficient. And I don't envy the airline's position at all. And I think that this is, you know, one of those battles where, okay, tell them that they need to maintain the legroom. How about that? But let them do 343 just so that they can have, because what this is going to result in, by the way, is that they're ultimately not going to update the economy cabin at all on these 777s. They were completely putting in beautiful new seats and all this stuff. So instead, they're going to update business and add premium economy, but then they're just going to leave the old economy seats to decay and become more and more outdated.
And they're going to point and blame the regulator for doing so, aren't they?
It's, yeah, But I don't blame them for not installing new seats, not to mention the fact that they've probably already ordered all the new economy seats they need. So happens to those seats now? It's messy, for sure.
It is messy. And you know, we see both sides. I guess, you know, if I was advising Korean Air, I would say try to embrace this and start marketing the economy as one of the, you know, the roomiest economy class, the most spacious economy class in Asia, or the most spacious. Japan Airlines would have something to say about that. But I would be marketing now how, unlike almost every other Boeing 777 operator on Earth, and remember the 777 is in service absolutely everywhere, one takes off or land every 30 seconds or so, Korean are in a unique position where, because they've had their hand forced into providing and maintaining that level of comfort, I say just go with it. Start marketing it as something that sets them apart from other airlines. We were on board the Korean Air 787-10, were we not, when we were in Seoul? Yeah. And we were super impressed with the product. I mean, they've really done well in their cabin design and the choices. I do think Korean Air struggled to get their message out globally. I mean, we went to a phenomenal event and we were buzzing from the, you know, the rebirth of Korean Air 2.0, this whole goal to get Korean Air the world's most loved airline. Well, I think this fits quite nicely into that category. I'd say that it's easy to be loved if you're able to show that actually you have now a really spacious economy class, leaving out the tiny detail that they were forced, of course. It's an interesting one. I just feel that they haven't got that they're really struggled to get that attention or capture the awareness of the flying public. I mean, unless their fares appear at the top of Skyscanner, they're still very much, you know, not the known option, not the option that comes to one's head for the rest of the world.
Which is, it's weird because Korea is so trendy and so popular. And
yeah,
I do get a lot of TikToks of people, especially in economy, raving about and being super excited about getting bibimbap on Korean Air, which is, I would say, the thing that gets them a lot of attention successfully.
Just explain what that is, right, in case listeners are unaware.
Oh, it's like the signature, I don't know if it's the national dish of Korea, but it's a very popular rice dish with some vegetables and usually some minced meat on top that you mix with a chili sauce, like a gochujang based sauce. And it is delicious. It's super popular in Korea. And apparently it's very nice when served on flights. So people seem to love that. But you're right. I think in a few weeks, we need to do a if we ran Korean Air, because there's a lot that I think we would do to try to get the name out there and make people want to fly them.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Let's move over from Korea, quite a way, over to London Heathrow's Terminal 5. Not A10, not today, but across all of Terminal 5, the home to Speedbird, British Airways, the flag carrier, IAG, Spanish, UK owned, Qatar largest shareholder, the moneymaker of the IAG group, at least when it comes to the transatlantic long haul. They're not so moneymaking on short haul. BA are not one to be in the headlines too often with these unusual style sudden rules for crew that we would expect at airlines who really care about the image of their crew. So the Gulf carriers, Singapore Airlines, you know, Singapore Airlines, there are so many TV shows that you can have a look on YouTube where the crew undergo this very aggressive style grooming, military, you know, kind of schedule. What is it that they go through? They go through this whole thing.
Yeah,
where
it's
they
like
have
a training for a K-pop star.
Yeah, basically. And it's like, it's, you know, they have one person who decides whether or not the Singapore girl, in inverted commas, as they were once known, will have to cut their hair, or they're going to be able to keep their hair, and how will they have their hair in a French twist, and is the French twist good enough? Otherwise, I have to cut it even more. And it's like, you know, and everything matters to them in terms of weight and appearance and how the uniform sits and the way in which they present their appearance, be it with makeup or anything. It's all that this matters a lot, and it's all part of the it's all very high up on the agenda for airlines like Singapore Airlines. That's not true for the European airlines. They are much more liberal and chill about all of it. And of course, many of them have uniform and grooming standards, as you would expect in a workplace where things should be kind of neat and tidy and so on. But nothing too weird until we saw this, because this is a bit weird. I'm putting this in the weird category. So BA has introduced new appearance guidance that bans crew from drinking anything except water in public. The idea is that crew will no longer, for example, be able to grab a coffee from Starbucks in Terminal 5 and walk to their gate and to their aircraft holding that coffee. Supposedly not allowed to stand in the galley and be in the view of other passengers drinking said coffee, despite the fact that many, for example, BA short haul flights take off between 6 and 7 a.m., which means a report time of before 5 o'clock in the morning. Let's go over to you first. What do you think of this? Because I tried to come to terms in my head as to why they could be doing this. Is this about the walk? Is this about the image when the crew are seen? What do you think?
Don't you feel that British Airways, I mean, a lot of European airlines especially, but British Airways is just so focused on the wrong things sometimes. Yeah. Like, there's so many obvious areas for them to actually improve.
Right.
And then this is like, no one, BA, you're not allowed to drink in public anymore. It just comes
across.
And of course,
the only reason why water is so mentioned wrong, because it's like a basic human right, right? So they've said that, you know, water is allowed. But actually, I mean, I've summarized. The text was, I felt, even harder, even more kind of harsher in its delivery, in that, you know, crew are now banned from drinking anything in public except water. That's it, point blank. What do we think is going? Why have they done this? What's happened?
So, well, what has there been an incident? Because I didn't see that there was an incident. Right?
No, not that has surfaced in public, at least. They don't want any walking and sipping. I spoke to some insiders, and they said they don't want any walking and sipping. I wonder. I then started to wonder: is it the stat? I mean, have you seen any crew with these massive Stanley cups? Is it this that they don't like? Do they not like the idea of crew walking to the aircraft and they're holding these massive? But I don't know if I've seen. And I've flown BA a lot over the last 3 months, and also I'm quite observant with noticing them in the terminal when they're walking to and from the aircraft, both at Heathrow but also abroad, because many of them night stop even in Europe. And I mean, it's not something that I've seen compared with when you see an American Airlines crew who are doing everything while they're walking, except just walking in a straight line.
They have like a liter sized cup of coffee as they're, it's crazy.
That they're holding that takeaway ready to take to the hotel room already that they've just grabbed when they got off the aircraft. And, you know, and then I think, well, I mean, they're not working, but, you know, maybe BA is trying to avoid this. Maybe they don't want, but I don't know, a little bit weird.
The funny thing is that last month when I flew BA, I actually gave one of the flight attendants a compliment on their water bottle, because I was waiting for the toilet in the galley and I saw that they had this really cool bottle where you basically put a sticker. It has like these holes kind of, and you put a sticker based on the destinations you've gone to. So he was like, yeah, I got like the whole sticker pack, and basically if I've flown to a destination in working for BA, I put that destination sticker in the circle for that on the bottle. I was like, that's awesome. Super cool. So it's funny how I was literally just giving a compliment on that, and now they're like, no drinking in public.
Good heavens. We started this segment with you wondering if there had been an incident, and little did we know that you were the incident. I mean, you've just confirmed it to us. This has got your name written all over it. You drew attention to this poor guy's innocent water bottle, and BA have come down with this drastic North Korean style, you're not allowed to drink anything except water rule, and you can't be seen holding a bottle. They've also banned, I'm sure you saw, they have banned commuting in uniform. So this may come as a surprise to many, but because the because British Airways predominantly based out of Terminal 5, of course, they've got their base at Gatwick as well. But here we're talking mostly about mainline BA out of Heathrow, Terminal 5 and 3. The cost of living in London, you don't need me to tell you, is incredibly high and is increasing year on year, and with inflation and rent prices, and it's you know, London is a very, very expensive place for people to live. So what many BA crew do is they live elsewhere on the BA network, typically elsewhere in the UK, and they commute
down. Or in
down.
Gothenburg.
Yeah, well, let's find someone who lives in Gothenburg and commutes to Terminal 5, and then we can talk. But until then, I think, you know, in the real world, that doesn't exist. But I'm happy to be proven.
Let's do it. Let's find that person.
Yeah. So many would choose to live, for example, anywhere else that BA flies domestically in the UK. So perhaps they live at a city in Scotland, or perhaps it's Manchester or Leeds, or even in France, where it's, you know, just over the water, over the channel. They would commute in for their flight to, which will all originate from Heathrow. And that's something that's quite common at BA. They've banned those commuting in to have been wearing their uniform when doing so. And most do, because let's say, for example, they're operating a lunchtime flight to New York, then typically they would commute down from, let's say, Manchester in the morning in uniform, ready for their working day, so that when they arrive at Heathrow, they then go to where they need to report at their crew center and start all the formalities there ahead of the flight. Why do we think they've banned? Is it because passengers confuse the individual as, you know, why are they sitting next to me? Shouldn't they be in the galley? Do they confuse them for working that yeah. flight? Is it about optics? Do you think that's why? Is it a safety thing?
Well, I don't think it's not a safety thing at all. It's about optics. They're choosing these weird things to focus on
yeah.
that they think will make the brand seem more premium, but it doesn't. One of my favorite things when flying BA, which I feel like you see it on almost every domestic flight in the UK, is when you see a Virgin Atlantic crew, especially the women in their lovely red uniforms, stepping onto BA. You're just like, oh, what a breath of fresh air. But I don't think it's weird at all. You see this on so many airlines. So
yeah.
BA is BAing and being weird. But what I like is that at least for this drink thing, there was so much backlash that they have decided to retreat, to allow crew to drink while they're seated only. So maybe you'll see crew sitting at the gate waiting to board if there's a crew swap or something like that. Then, of course, they should be able to drink. Maybe there, if anything, there could be a limitation on, like, you're not allowed to be seen drinking a hot chocolate with lots of whipped cream and marshmallows while in uniform at the boarding gate. Like, maybe it should be the drink is concealed so you can't see what it, like, it's
but then don't you think that gets a bit ridiculous as well? Because then what's the problem? If why is the passenger offended by whipped cream? Like, seriously, yeah, it starts to get ridiculous. Yeah, I know, but hypothetically, you know, why is the passenger affected by whipped cream? Similarly, of course, they've had to retreat and take steps back. And this has been a whole fiasco for them. And there is this quiet U-turn now where they've said that, oh, no, what we meant, and everyone is, no, we know what you meant because you were crystal clear. But the funny part is, of course, the unions got involved, understandably so, because crew were saying, if the crew are not allowed to have coffee, which basically powers 70% of cabin crew because of the way in which their sleep uh-huh. schedules are all over the place, then BA are going to have far greater issues with the onboard service decline that would follow if crew are not able to have coffee than me being offended by a cabin crew walking through a terminal holding a drink, like almost everyone else in that. The fact that they also say that all of this is to help BA become even more premium. Please let us give you a list of 100 things, and we assure you that on that list of 100, crew walking with a coffee in hand will not feature anywhere. I don't even think it would feature in the first 200 or 500 ideas, because there is so much that could be done. This is not it.
Let's start by, in that case, if they're so concerned about the optics, having a uniform that actually makes people look, because no one is, you know, no offense, but no one is turning their heads to look at a BA crew walking through the terminal. People will turn and stare at an Emirates crew, at a Singapore Airlines crew, at a Hainan Airlines crew, a crew that wears a really iconic, stunning uniform. And then if everyone is looking at you, yeah, maybe you're not holding a 1 liter Dunkin' Donuts coffee, but if you have such a bland uniform to start with, let's start there, you know?
Yeah, it's unsurprising that they have had to U-turn on that and kind of water it down a bit, if you'll pardon the pun. But I really do wonder as to what could have happened. Actually, you know what? I don't wonder. We'll move to the next segment. I know what happened. It was you and that guy's water bottle. It was all you. It's got your name written all over it. Let's move into the final segment of the episode. We are going to do an if we ran. And today's airline or airport is, Dan?
Drum roll. We are going to take over Iceland Air for the next 10-15 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to get my puffer jacket and gloves, and we're ready to bring the Northern Lights experience to the listeners. But speaking seriously, let's go through a key points. What would we do if we ran Icelandair? Because I think to set the scene, Icelandair have a pretty unique place in commercial aviation. Iceland is strategically located between Europe and North America. And they are leveraging this in order to provide stopover programs, in order to encourage people to visit Iceland. More people are visiting Iceland year on year. More people are stopping and transiting in Iceland, taking advantage of lower fares and the option to have like a 1 or 2 day stopover, maybe even see the Northern Lights if you're lucky, see what Iceland has to offer. But there is, like many airlines, you know, room for On Air with Dan and Alex improvements. And so I just wanted to come to you first and know, what would you do if we ran Iceland Air?
The thing that's so frustrating about Iceland Air is that they're one of those rare carriers that is a hybrid, full-service, low-cost airline. Some parts of the experience, especially in economy, are very low-cost, like charging for food. I think I could be completely wrong because I haven't flown Iceland Air Economy in like 9 years. But back then, I'm pretty sure they used to charge to use the in-flight entertainment system. So they have a screen on the seat back, but you have to pay to use it. Things like that, that make it's such a frustrating thing, I think, as a passenger to not know, is this a full service airline, or is this an airline where I'm going to need to pay for everything? Because being somewhere in the middle, I don't think makes anyone happy, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. And there is a level of confusion in that they want to operate with something that feels a bit more premium, with that Saga business class. But also, as you said, there is a real kind of low-cost carrier mentality in economy. I think if we ran Iceland Air, I would want to right size it into a place where there was a solid economy class with all the kind of bells and whistles by default. So the standard onboard service, decent in-flight entertainment, I'd be looking at Wi-Fi, things like that. Nothing too extravagant, but being able to offer a decent economy that would achieve, I guess, similar to what Finnair did with things like the onboard lighting and the Northern Lights push, and just really make it feel as Icelandic as possible in order to get people excited about choosing to cross the Atlantic via Iceland rather than nonstop and direct. And having that Iceland experience tangible and something that you can really feel from the moment you board across all cabin classes with this big push. And I think there is room for them to push harder on the stopover. I think the whole stopover can be simplified and can be kind of put together in such a way that it would be silly not to, rather than it would be extra or it would be something that you can do. But where a lot of the, for example, Gulf carriers have been successful in their stopover programs is boosting their domestic tourism by being really generous and subsidizing these stopover programs, because they know that if passengers experience for a couple of days something that they enjoy, then typically they'll return, whereas it's always difficult to get them to go for the first time. So I would focus on a guaranteed stopover, a kind of like one-click, 48-hour solution with different extras that are included when you do stop over. So the checked bags by default, and the onboard meal for everyone by default, and decent in-flight entertainment with really rich content on Iceland to really push brand Iceland. That's what I would want from Iceland Air.
That's good. Don't you think that it doesn't make sense to me anymore in this day and age that Iceland Air is not only not part of an alliance, but why can't they be part of a transatlantic joint venture? So look, this is what I picture for Iceland Air. Connecting in the US sucks in so many ways. Mm-hmm. You need to clear immigration on arrival in the city you land in, even if you're connecting to a different city. You need to recheck your luggage. So there's so many elements of stress. And if you land and you see a long immigration line, it's going to ruin your experience. Personally, I would never recommend anyone to connect in the US like that. So why not have Iceland Air join a transatlantic joint venture? And the question would be, which one? We could think about that. But have these airlines, so let's say hypothetically it was Air France KLM. So have Air France KLM and SAS shuttle all these passengers from their hubs in Europe to Reykjavik. From there, have Iceland Air, yes, they can continue flying to New York to their most profitable destinations, but then really narrow in on flying to secondary cities, places that people are connecting to through JFK, through Boston, through Washington. Like go to Nashville, I know Aer Lingus is starting to fly to some of these places, but I think they should really narrow in on getting people and pushing this narrative that will get you to your secondary city in the US without you having to connect in the US. It's such a big benefit. And I think that if they had the backing and the partnership of a bigger airline group, that could be a really powerful model.
I think you're right. It's definitely, the USP that could be developed in that to be able to, let's talk about if you haven't had a stopover, but rather you just transit, to do that in the calm kind of the environment that Iceland can offer at the hub in Reykjavik, rather than having to go through all that horror with the US is itself something that they need to push more. They also are set up with the right fleet for that already. They operate the 321LR, for example. They have 737 MAX, but everywhere is within their reach because of their strategic location. So I agree. I would go harder on the US push. And it's interesting because the low-cost carriers were able to do this a bit more successful. I mean, WOW have gone bust now. But when they were when they were up and running, they were No, they were never very WOW. But they were known for US. And it was that was very much in everyone's heads as to how WOW could get them to the US, to different cities on a budget. I wonder where Iceland Air would fit with partnerships in Europe and why that hasn't happened. But they need to be in an alliance, and if not, then they need more connectivity and more options to be able to stand firm. I'd put them, you mentioned a European carrier, but there is also opportunity over in North America where they could, have a decent alliance. JetBlue could take them to manage the flows.
Yeah, or Southwest is actually starting to partner with Iceland Air.
Exactly. Now. And that's nice and strategic given the location of Southwest, and Iceland Air don't really have that level of reach just yet. So yeah, that brand Iceland, focusing on the US, you could almost, you could compare stopping over in Iceland for your flight to the US as some kind of US pre-clearance. It would be a very optimistic for US to get that for them to get US pre-clearance, but it is just a better experience, as you said, than making that stopover in Boston or New York and then having to continue elsewhere in the States.
Yeah. So Iceland Air, if you're listening, where are your partnerships? Let's go. Let's try to really strengthen something here. I think the one airline transatlantic joint venture where I don't think this makes sense is Lufthansa Group, just because they're so big already, but Air France KLM is, you know, one that operates to such limited cities across the Atlantic. We're just talking Paris, Amsterdam, and that's pretty much it. So, you know, I mean, also IAG could work, but I think we need this. Or as we said, or as you said, we could do, if they partnered full on with Southwest to shuttle people from all types of secondary cities in the US to Iceland, and then Iceland there says, okay, we'll take over from here and shuttle those people to not only the popular tourist destinations in Europe, but then also fly to secondary cities in Europe so that we can bring people to bigger cities in the US. I think that's what they need, because they're all alone up there. And it's so sad that they're on this little island, not utilizing the power of teaming up, especially given that they have this really agile fleet.
Yeah.
They don't really invest in a premium product. So, you know, they can go where there's economy demand, which tends to be more secondary cities. Their primary aircraft is the 737 MAX 8. So it's not even that big. It has 160 seats. Like, it's perfect.
I think that was a decent if we ran segment with lots of content for our friends at Icelandair to think about. Shall we jump into Q&A?
So let's start out here with a question from Siddharth, who asks us, have we seen Singapore Airlines' new safety video? What did we think? He says, it feels like a good balance between entertaining and normal, similar to what BA has done. What did you think?
I was gutted personally that the one that we like is no more.
Yes.
So even before I clicked play, I was, no, why did they change it? Because I just think the other one was so excellent at getting me excited for Singapore. And it was just so beautifully quaint and visually rich and Singaporean. And so I was really gutted that they changed it. I do think that the new one is not bad. It's not bad. It's nice. It hasn't changed too much in the sense of style or direction, but it doesn't show me as much as Singapore as the first one. And I really like the first one for that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it's decent, but I feel like it's a little bit cheap, or a little like it's not as premium as the old one. The old one was just like, this is Singapore Airlines. The intro to the new video, the outro, those keep the same essence, but there's something about showing like those people, there's some, maybe are they doing Tai Chi or something in a park, and then there's dragons. I just feel like,
yeah, that's the good
SQ
stuff.
SQ is not the everyday airline. It's a special occasion airline.
True.
And that's what, you know, I wish they had leaned into, but you know, it's good. They haven't gone too over the top, at least, and they're trying to convey the important info, which is great. So here we have a question from Serena. She says, another great episode and welcome back. I've missed you guys. I totally agree regarding boarding premium cabins first, then frequent flyer elites, followed by people needing assistance and people with children under 2 years old. Not every single child under 12.
Yeah. 12. Please, I was flying alone at 12.
I know. Yeah, that is a good distinction. That's and then true. this is very, very true that they shouldn't allow the entire accompanying party to board early with the person who needs to board, because this is something I feel we see all the time.
Yes.
There's one person in a wheelchair and then they're traveling with 11 other people and you're like, what? What is going on? And then all those people board early.
Yeah, that's, you're right. Crazy. I just had that recently at Terminal 3 at Heathrow. And they did actually, they did ask, they said, are we able to go as well? And he said, yeah. And then she literally turned back and called, as you said, like a party of 10. I was like, oh my God. And it was, and it was for a kid. It wasn't for that someone requiring special assistance. It was just, you know, kids were invited to board, as I had spoken about. But yeah,
that's a
good point.
We have a lot of questions here about if we ran. So Serena also asks, if we ran Malaysia Airlines, what will we do? That's a good one for a future episode.
Yeah.
Then we have a question here from, I can't see the name, but they say, hi guys, love listening to both of you on the podcast. You guys accompany me on my daily commutes. I had a quick question. Given the choice between flying with a preferred airline or arriving at a preferred destination, what would you choose? So, for example, my family is flying from Mexico, and when we would visit, we had two choices. We could either fly our preferred airline, Aeromexico, and land in Guadalajara, or we could fly Volaris and land at our preferred destination, Leon. So I think that's interesting because especially for me when I'm trying to work the points game, I don't always have the option to fly what I want to fly to where I want to fly. What would you do?
I think it depends on the trip. And most of the time, the destination takes position there and takes priority. So I think destination first. But it does depend on how flexible you can be and depends on the trip. I was just recently in this scenario helping my friend who was flying to Crete, and his hotel was, there are two airports that serve Crete, one on one side of the island, one on the other, and his hotel was closer to one, but he wanted to fly to the other because he wanted the connection to be through Aegean Business. He didn't want to have to kind of exit into Athens, come back in with a different airline with Sky Express and whatever. So in that scenario, he chose the seamless connection point of view, even though he knew when he arrived he had a longer drive compared with if he had just done the transit a little bit differently in Athens. So I think it just depends on the trip, basically.
I appreciate your perspective because I completely do the opposite. I would rather fly somewhere that's not necessarily where I need to be be on a good airline and then connect if we're talking long haul, because there's often the option of flying direct on a not so great airline, and in that case I always think it's more fun to make the flight something you enjoy, and in that case taking a bit of a detour I think is totally
it depends on the trip. You need to get where you need to get to with the level of urgency or on a specific date or time, or if you've got the flexibility to say, you know what, I'm going to do it the nice way even if it's going to take me 17 hours instead of 10, for example.
That's a good point. Final question here from Harrison. He says, love the podcast. I have a question for you regarding Finnair. I know you guys often speak highly of Finnair, especially their long-haul business class product. However, I've flown multiple times in their long-haul economy and personally feel it leaves a lot to be desired. A few things I noticed included no pillows, small meal portions, no mid-flight snacks, and having to pay for alcohol outside of the meal service, just to name a few. Do you feel the same? And what are your thoughts on Finnair's economy offering? And I think this points to something that we and so many people in the travel industry are very guilty of, that we tend to judge an airline based on their premium cabins alone, because that to us is just what feels more interesting. It's what sets them apart much more. But this is a good reminder that, we know the vast majority of people are in economy, but an economy experience on an airline that has a great business class can actually be terrible.
Yeah, you're right. And I think Finnair, unfortunately, has been recently, the whole cost cutting thing. And I think that's what we're seeing now come into play. Their cost cutting has been quite aggressive in their quest for profitability. And it all kind of stems from what really changed with Finnair once Russia had invaded Ukraine, and then the difficulty that they were put in. So yeah, it's not a great direction that they're heading in terms of the onboard experience and the cuts that they've made. And that's also evident in their premium cabins as well. It's that plus what we
I'm always the Finnair offender. I don't think that their business class has suffered. I know some people think that the catering is not great, but everyone who I've booked and my family and friends on Finnair loved the catering. I think for Scandinavians, it's our cup of tea. Mm. And they were one of the fastest airlines in the world that I can think of to reconfigure their entire fleet with fantastic new seats. They did so fast, even on the A350s where they didn't have to do it.
True.
So I just think the little caveat, the little asterisk here is that in general, when we say we love an airline or an airline is good, unfortunately, we're usually talking about the premium experience. We're not saying that just because we love Finnair, or just because we love another airline, that their economy is necessarily something we love on the same level.
But there are those, and that's why you have to hear that throughout various episodes, there are those that we really rate in economy. And we've often done segments or discussions where we had said that if you were flying to, and we insert the destination, who would you fly in order to ensure that you have the best economy class experience as possible? Because not all economies are created equal. That's the fact. And sometimes you can really, you know, sometimes depending on where you're flying to, you can have an excellent choice, especially if you're flying to Asia, where so many airlines are operating. And you bring up a flight comparison site on Google Flights, for example, and you see that there's very often only $50 to $150 between maybe 10 options. So it's at that point that you need to be savvy, know what aircraft type are operating, and know that not all economy classes are created equal. Some are going to be superior compared to others. And that's why you have to stay informed, listen to the podcast, and make sure that you're making the right choices so you have the best experience possible.
100%. But sometimes it's also the inverse, where we are not always the most positive about US airlines, for example. But I know that a lot of people feel that Delta, especially in economy class, is really, really good. And they give you a lot of snacks and they give you some amenities and yeah, their seats are nice. So, you know, that's an example where we would say, oh, Delta, I don't know if, you know, overrated. But in fact, in economy, they might be great. So
yeah,
it's
yeah,
tricky.
It is tricky. No one size fits answer. But that's why we have our episodes, to try to navigate those answers and to get them to you. Cool. Well, I think we'll wrap on today's, and we invite your questions, as always, to our shared Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex. And we'll regroup in the same time, same place next week, or wherever you get your podcast. Dan, good to speak with you.
Likewise. We will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,